Tonight I plan to start Samuel. Kay and I watched a Hillsdale College online course by a professor named Justin Jackson. And he was a literature professor. He was focusing on it from a literature perspective, mostly on David. But the idea was that he was interested in what the two books said about fathers. I am too. I will probably channel some of his ideas. I didn't take notes in his class, so I'm not going to be able to attribute precisely this idea or that idea, but just so everybody knows, I did get some of my ideas from him. Samuel is written about 1050 BC, and what it does is it chronicles the change of Israel from a system of judges to a monarchy. That takes place over the two books of Samuel, and we see Samuel himself, and then we see the elevation of Saul and Saul's downfall and failure, and then we see the elevation of David, and in many ways, David's downfall and failures. And Jackson was mostly interested in that. I'm also interested in the history of it all. In the spirit of Jackson, who was talking about fathers, we have the failure of several fathers in this book. The first failure of a father that we notice is Eli. Eli is the high priest, and his two sons are corrupt, and we'll read about them tonight. And God comes and curses his entire line. The second failure is the failure of Samuel himself. What happens with Samuel is he judges Israel for a good long time. And when the nation says, we want to have ourselves a king, one of the things they say is, your sons do not walk in your ways. So Samuel himself is not a particularly good father in bringing up his sons to be worthy of following after him. And that's a contributor to Israel wanting to get out from a system of judges and into a monarchy. And then, of course, Saul isn't particularly a failure as a father. Saul is a failure as a king. And by the end of his life, he is quite insane. He's paranoid, among other things. And then we have David, and 2 Samuel is a chronicle of the problems in David's family. The whole thing starts with Bathsheba, where he takes another man's wife, and we'll talk about Bathsheba when we get there. She's a very interesting character in her own right. And in the text, because of the incident with Bathsheba, God puts a curse on David and says, all of the things that you did to Uriah and so forth are going to be done to you four times. And we see that literally played out. By the end of his monarchy, David doesn't discipline his sons, and his sons run amok, and we wind up with Solomon as the king, and Solomon then turns around and kills one of his brothers. So as we go through Samuel, I'm going to be looking at sort of two aspects of it. One is the history, because there's a lot of history and terrain and stuff in the book, and that's interesting in its own right. But also I'm going to be interested in the human aspect of it, the character, if you will, of the various people involved. So that's what I'm going to try and do. So, as I was saying, Samuel lived somewhere around 1050 BC, and I would say it's the beginning of Israel's problems, but that isn't really true, because we see in the Judges that Israel has a yo-yo career. They go after idols and worship the local gods, and everything turns into a mess, and they cry out to God. God sends them a judge. The judge delivers them from whatever their current problem is, and then the judge lives for a while, and then the judge dies, and then we go back and rinse and repeat. We won't get into Kings and Chronicles, but you see the same thing with a king. And it finally, of course, gets to the point where The way I would describe it is it's a damped oscillation. A damped oscillation, it starts off big, and over time it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. That's what happens. You hit a gong, and bong, oh, that's a damped oscillation. So let's look at Israel's righteousness as a damped oscillation. When they come out of Egypt, and you've got the generation that came through the wilderness, who witnessed what happened to the generation that came out of Egypt. The generation that came out of Egypt died in the wilderness. So their children were the ones that go into the land. And of course, the book of Judges starts when that generation has died off. And it explicitly says that. So you have this generation that had firsthand experience with the presence of God, saw what God did to people who didn't trust in him, and boy, they were right there. But one of the things that Moses tells them is when you go into the land, destroy all of the people there. Just wipe them all out. And of course, they don't do that. So you wind up having all of these pagans in their little pagan towns dotted throughout Israel, and they become a snare to the people of Israel, and we get pagan worship and so forth. And the damped oscillation part is, starts with bong, really righteous, in the generation that came out of the wilderness, and that righteousness over centuries gradually damps out until we get to the time of the Assyrian invasion and the Babylonian invasion, when the righteousness of Israel is barely perceptible, and all you have are prophets then that come and talk for God and say, there's no more righteousness here. And of course, when we went through, I don't remember whether it was Ezekiel or Jeremiah, since we've been through both of them recently, God says of Jerusalem, if Daniel, Noah, and Moses lived there, I wouldn't spare the place. So the righteousness in Israel, if you will, has damped out to the point where they're gone. So what we see in Samuel is a continuation of the damping out of the righteousness of the nation. And the signature event in the Samuel books is giving up the system of judges and going to a monarchy, which God is not pleased with, but it is a continuation of a decline that began with the death of the wilderness generation. So that's sort of a large overview of what's going on. All right, so Samuel 1. There was a certain man of Ramathaim, Zophim, in the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Joram, the son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Zuph, an Ephrathite. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this man used to go up year by year from the city to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. So obviously your setup is that they go once a year to the temple and they sacrifice. And of course the sacrifices that they are bringing, I am inferring, are either Todah or Shelemim, which is thank offerings or peace offerings, because we have barbecue. And one of the things that goes on is they eat the sacrifice, which is typical of a Todah or a Shelemim, not a Olah or a sin offering. So verse 4. And on the day that when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah he gave a double portion, because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival used to provoke her grievously to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? So obviously Elkanah very much loves his wife, and she is obviously distraught about not having children. Verse 9. After they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on the seat outside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. Now I am assuming here that we don't have a building, but we have the tabernacle. I do not know if that's correct. It's certainly entirely possible that it's a tabernacle, because the tabernacle had posts, a gate post, and so forth, so that's entirely possible. It's also possible that they built a structure. I just don't know the answer to that. Although, you remember in Jeremiah, we have this riff where the people who are apostate say there's no way anything can happen to the city because we got the temple of the Lord here, and he certainly won't let anybody destroy his temple. And God says through the prophet, go look at Shiloh. Used to be the temple there. Now there's nothing. So if you don't think that I will destroy the place where my name resides, think again. Comment was that when David has it in his mind to build a temple, he says that I, David, live in cedar houses and the Lord lives in a tent. So it's entirely possible that it's a tent here as it was in the wilderness. And in fact, when David asked to build a tabernacle, God says, what do I need a tabernacle for? I've always been in a tent. So I don't doubt that that's probably correct. Comment was the Hebrew word used here for where Eli is sitting is a large public building. So I don't know. Anyway, we'll assume for the moment it's a tent, but I'm not sure. Verse 10. She, Hannah, was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. By the way, we haven't said this in a long time, so I will review for purposes of the recording. She took a vow. You all know the difference between a vow and an oath. An oath is a promise to perform. So if I say I will meet you at Dunkin' Donuts at 10 o'clock tomorrow, that's an oath. I'm promising to do something. If on the other hand, I say I will not eat grapes for 30 days, a Nazarite vow, what has happened is I've changed the status of grapes, which are normally permitted, to something that is not permitted to me. What Hannah has done here is she has changed the status of her son. Assuming she has a son, that son's status is now changed. He is going to be a Nazarite from birth, and he is going to be dedicated to God. In much the same way as a Nazarite vow changes the status of all grapes, so Hannah, in her vow, has changed the status of her son. And in that case, the word vow is correct here. She's not making a promise, she's changing status. Verse 12. And she continued praying before the Lord. Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, how long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you. But Hannah answered, no, my lord, I'm a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. Then Eli answered, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition as you have made to him. And she said, let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So the combination of her prayer and the priest ratifying her prayer has calmed her spirit. So she's able now to go eat, even though obviously she is not at this point pregnant. Verse 19, they rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house in Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son. And she called his name Samuel, for she said, I have asked for him from the Lord. Samuel, by the way, means his name is God. That's according to Strong's. Feels more like God heard, or God listened, or God heard me, or that kind of thing. 21. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer to the Lord the yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, as soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him, so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. Now, I don't know at what age children are weaned in biblical Israel, but I know there are cultures where children are not weaned until they're years old or more. The point is, what Eli doesn't need is an infant or a toddler. What Eli needs is a young boy who is able to go get him a cup of water or something like that and be somewhat useful. In addition to which, obviously, separating an infant from its mother would be not good for the infant or the mother, either one. So obviously, I don't know at what age they were weaned, but I'm assuming it's not toddler age. I'm assuming it's at the age like 5 or 6. Verse 23, Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what seems best to you and wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word." I just saw this. You remember in the Torah, when a woman makes a vow and her husband doesn't agree with it, he has to cancel it. And there isn't any indication until right now that Samuel has been dedicated to God. Hannah has said that, but we don't have any information about whether Elkanah knows it. At least on the surface here, what she says at that point is, "As soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever." And Elkanah ratifies that vow. Elkanah, her husband, said to her, "Do what is best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word." One way you can read that is, oh, okay, that's how we got a child, huh? Fine, do it. In which case, Elkanah has then ratified the vow of Hannah. He may have already known about it. I don't know that, but this is the first indication in Scripture. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, and a skin of wine. And she brought them to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, "O my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord." And she worshiped the Lord there. Now, the way this is written, Eli isn't sitting there expecting a child to show up. She shows up with this kid in tow and says, "Here you go." But the point here is, we're not sure when she made her vow known to anybody. Certainly, she doesn't appear to have made her vow known to Eli until she shows up with the child. So now we're going to get to Hannah's prayer, chapter 2. And by the way, we will compare this with Mary's prayer, because although Mary's prayer is much shorter, it contains most of the same elements. So Hannah prayed and said, "My heart exalts in the Lord. My strength is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation." Pause there for just a minute. It's a fairly common thing, and in fact, Mary will say the same thing about God triumphing over enemies. So it's hard to say whether the enemies that Hannah is triumphing over here are generic enemies of the people, if you will, or her fellow wife. It may be a double entendre. I don't know. Verse 2. "There is none holy like the Lord. There is none besides you. There is no rock like our God. Talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed." As I read this, all I can remember is the first chapter where she kept getting harassed and mocked and ridiculed by Elkanah's other wife. I don't know what's going through her mind as she says this, but I can't help wondering. Verse 4, "The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry have ceased to hunger. The barren has borne 7, but she who has many children is forlorn. The Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust. He lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. He will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. Now, at this point, there isn't any question that she's not talking about her other wife. It's starting to get pretty grim. I can see sort of a snark at the beginning, but as you get toward the end, the snark goes away and it's straightforward. So verse 9, he will guard the feet of his faithful ones, but the wicked shall be cut off in darkness. For not by might shall a man prevail. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Against them he will thunder in heaven. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth. He will give strength to his king and exalt the power of his anointed. Then Elkanah went home to Ramah, and the boy ministered to the Lord in the presence of Eli the priest. Let's swing over to Luke 1, which is Mary's equivalent prayer or exaltation as she discovers that she's pregnant. So I'm in Luke 1:46. And Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior." That sounds just exactly like the beginning of Hannah's prayer. "For he has looked on the humble estate of his servant, for behold, from now on all generations will call me blessed. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of humble estate. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham and his offspring forever." So you've got all the same elements in both prayers. Obviously, Hannah is more wordy and perhaps a bit more fierce, being Old Testament like it is. So, all right, we're down to verse 12 in 1 Samuel 2. "Now the sons of Eli were worthless men." Pretty all-inclusive there. "They did not know the Lord. The custom of the priests with the people was that when a man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling, with a three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there." Now stop there for a minute. As I remember my Leviticus, there is a specific portion that belongs to the priest for a sacrifice. And it's the shoulder, I think, and the stomach. And when I say stomach, I'm assuming flank steak kind of thing. The point is, there is a designated specific part that is for the priest. There's nothing in Leviticus that says, run up there with a fork and stab into the pot and whatever comes up is yours. That's the first thing. They're not doing what it says in the Torah. Verse 15, "Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servants would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, 'Give me meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw.' And if the man said to him, 'Let them burn the fat first and then take as much as you wish,' he would say, 'No, you must give it now. If not, I will take it by force.'" So he does not want pot roast. What he wants is raw meat that he can start from scratch with. And the priest's portion, if we go with the Torah, doesn't say that it has to be boiled or taken from the pot. It's just, this is your portion. These guys are just sort of rolling their own. And obviously the people who are coming up recognize that these guys are just rolling their own. And, you know, say, "Hey, wait a minute, let's get this sacrifice done right first and then take what you want." And these guys say, "Nah, we'll just take what we want now." Comment was, one of the reasons they may want it raw is so they can sell it. And certainly in the case of the hide, which I believe is their due, there's nothing that says then they can't turn around and sell it. The hide is not kadosh, is not set apart. Now, the meat that they take is kadosh. And you remember that the meat that is given as the priest's portion must only be eaten by, I believe, the priest and his immediate family, who is clean. In other words, they have to be in a state of tahar. So all of this stuff that they're doing here is in violation of Torah, and God is not amused. So verse 17, thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. This whole thing starts off as that they are worthless men and do not know the Lord. So they are looking upon all of this as simply a business. This is our job, and we're going to operate it so that it runs the way we want it to, as opposed to the way God says it should. Comment was that if you ever go to a Catholic Mass, you will be impressed with the precision and reverence that the priests treat all of the objects and food on the altar. These guys obviously are not doing it the same way. Verse 18, Samuel was ministering before the Lord, a boy clothed with a linen ephod, and his mother used to make him a little robe and take it to him each year when she went up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. So the kid obviously grows, and every year she would make him a new little coat and take it up to him. Obviously, he's her son, and she loves him, and so forth. 20. Then Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, may the Lord give you children by this woman for the petition she asked of the Lord. So then they would return to their home. Indeed, the Lord visited Hannah, and she conceived and bore 3 sons and 2 daughters. And the young man Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. And I don't know if the 3 sons includes Samuel or 3 more. 22. Now Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear of your evil dealings with all the people. No, my sons, it is no good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. Now the young man Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and also with man. So what we're setting up here is a contrast between Samuel and the 2 sons. 27. And there came a man of God to Eli and said to him, thus the Lord has said, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh? Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go to my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me? I gave to the house of your father all my offerings by fire from the people of Israel. Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded, and honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel? Notice God's attitude toward this. I said earlier, Eli is not corrupt per se. He is simply not raising his sons properly. God looks upon that and says, 29, why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offering that I commanded and honor your sons above me? You fear the opinion of your sons more than you fear the opinion of God. Verse 30, therefore, the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promised that your house and the house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. Behold, the days are coming when I will cut off your strength and the strength of your father's house, so that there will not be an old man in your house. The curse there is you will die young, and all of your sons will die young. So you will not have an old man in the house, which is to say, you will not have somebody who has accumulated wisdom by years and has been able to pass that on to the family. You're going to be able to get married, you're going to have kids and so forth, but you're not going to be an old man, nor will any of your sons. 32. Then in distress you will look with envious eye on all the prosperity that shall be bestowed on Israel, and there shall not be an old man in your house forever. The only one of you whom I shall not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. And this that shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be the sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. So you've got this prophet that shows up and starts reading Eli the riot act. And Eli could certainly look at that the way Hezekiah said that it'll be all right in my generation, but this is going to come upon my sons. I'll die in peace. So Eli could certainly look upon it that way, as in, okay, so my descendants are going to die young, at least I'm okay. But he says the sign of this is going to be that your two sons are going to die the same day. That's how you're going to know that this is correct and I am speaking for the Lord. Comment was, you will weep your eyes out. I'm not sure that's what that means. Let me read 33 again. The only one of you whom I do not cut off from my altar shall be spared to weep his eyes out, to grieve his heart, and all the descendants of your house shall die by the sword of men. I am sort of thinking that that applies to descendants. You're thinking it applies to Eli himself. I hadn't thought of it that way. It very well could apply to Eli himself. In fact, in one of the comments from Justin Jackson, is when Eli finds out that his sons have been killed and falls over backwards and breaks his neck and dies, the last thing he asks about is the Ark of the Lord, not his sons. And Jackson's comment was he was more concerned about the Ark than he was about his own sons. Do with that as it seems good to you. Interesting comment. So 34 again. And this that shall come upon your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, shall be a sign to you. Both of them shall die on the same day. And I will raise up for myself a faithful priest, who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind. And I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before my anointed forever. And everyone who is left in your house shall come to implore him for a piece of silver or a loaf of bread, and shall say, please, put me in one of the priest's places that I may eat a morsel of bread. So obviously, Eli is of the line of Levi, but there are others of the line of Levi as well. And there are others of the line of the priest as well. So Eli's line of priesthood is going to be diminished, and God is going to pick another line of the sons of Aaron to be priests. And what's going to happen is the line of Eli is going to be impoverished. And as I'm sure you all know, the deal was in Israel, if anybody who is a descendant of Aaron and is a priest is welcome to come to the temple and be taken in and serve. And he will eat of the sacrifices and do all of that. So what the prophet is saying here is your line is going to be diminished, and the only service you're going to be able to do is when you're desperate, you walk to the temple or the tabernacle and say, I'm a priest, I want to serve for a while just so I can eat. So we'll quit there at the end of chapter 2. So next time we'll polish off Hophni and Phinehas, and we'll get to the call of Saul.